Good evening, everybody, and welcome to part four of the Alternative Preparation course with myself, Scott Cassin-Rennie, himself, Mr. Al Coates.
Evening, Hello. Al. Hello there.
Who looks like a little leprechaun sat on his little stool there tonight.
Don't start me tonight. Don't. I'm a man on the edge. I literally am on the edge tonight, so please do not start on me tonight.
Okay, well, it's an alternative background. It's one that we've not seen before, so we'll be interested to hear more about that little bit later. But tonight we're joined by David Benjamin. Hello, David. You all right?
Hello there. Nice to be here.
Thank you for joining us. So just as a way of introduction, really, do you want to introduce yourself? Tell us who you are, what you do, where you come from, do a Cilla Black on us, whatever you want to do.
My name is David Benjamin. Currently live in Stockton-on-Tees. I'm a therapist, and I was adopted when I was 6 weeks old. Born in South Shields. So does that make me a Geordie? Does it officially?
No.
Is that the wrong side of the river? I'm not sure. Yep.
Nope. Oh, it's black and white, isn't it? Does that make you
a Geordie? No.
I guess South Shields would be a sand dancer, I think is the term, which I think is fantastic. Is it? Anyway, Bondi, the Angel of the North. I've got a story. I sit on a foster panel at the moment. I've also been on what was Middlesbrough Council and then Adoption Tees Valley panel for the last 10 years. Okay. And I'm on the foster panel for Cornerstone, fostering agency. So obviously my passion is adoption, working with trauma. I'm a good friend of Vicky McEwen, who was on here a couple of weeks ago. Worked with Vicky. We share the same passions of working with teenagers and training and things. So that's me. And my day job is a self-employed therapist, private practice. In Stockton-on-Tees.
Yeah. So I don't wish to be rude, but you were adopted at 6 weeks old.
Mm.
I mean, you're not. I'm going to assume you're not part of the Children Act generation. Maybe a little bit before that. Would that be right?
1973, I was adopted.
Okay. All right. Yeah.
So before 75.
He looks younger than you, Al.
No.
And you're the same.
I mean, we've just met, but clearly you've had an easy.
I know. I was trying not to. I was trying to say, how old are you? I mean, you know, whether you're male, female, or you know, whatever gender you are, nobody likes to really be asked your age. I was trying to gauge in terms of when, you know, what kind of, what the adoption kind of background has been, just in case we don't get to that. But
good fishing.
I'm 50. I'm 50 next year.
Excellent. Yeah. Just a babe. I kind of the caveat. To all of this discussion, really, is that we're working on the presumption that adoption, we're cool with adoption, because otherwise the preparation group doesn't work. Otherwise, you can't. It's not as simple as that. We would, you know, if it was a different conversation, we'd be talking about, you know, how we would all that. But I guess we're just working on the presumption that people are going to adopt, and adopting needs to happen. We can have that conversation another time, perhaps. So, I have lots of questions because I think you are this kind of a Venn diagram of adoption, aren't you? You've got,
you've
got personal experience, professional experience, voluntary experience. So as a starting point, which is exact opposite of what I've just said, is what are your personal sort of views on adoption from your own personal perspective? Or maybe a better way of saying it is, when you sit in front of a group of people who are being prepared, because you've done that, what do you say to them?
I used to go to the prep groups for Adoption Tees Valley to tell my story. So I would be the person they're getting on the week that they're getting adoptee to come to tell their story. And I go through my story. Feel free to ask me about it. You know, I've found my birth mother and family and all that craziness. And I think I said to you, didn't I, Al, when we were sort of messaging, you know, adopters are my superheroes. And I always say at the end of my little talk that I do for prep groups, you know, on behalf of all the lost babies in this world, you know, just thank you. You're my heroes. And it, people start to cry, and it's like, it obviously touches people that someone who's being adopted sees them as, you know, heroic. And I don't say that lightly. I don't say that flippantly. I absolutely, with all my heart, see you as heroes, you know, for what you've done. So yeah, my view on adoption is amazing. You know, I love it. You know,
I'm holding my breath now because I have this. Scott probably knows what I'm going to say. Is I'm conscious that that's not necessarily the widely held view from adopted people.
Not the daily view we get anyway, is it?
Yeah, right. That's interesting.
We're going to get stern letters to our complaints department now, I can tell, maybe our listenership. But that is, I understand why they get you on preparation groups. That makes sense, because you are pro. But is there an element of, this is exactly the opposite of what I was going to do at the beginning, wasn't it? We're talking about adoption preparation. I want to go, but why? I'm not going to resist that till the end. I'm going to resist. So thinking about people who are sort of stepping onto the adoption conveyor belt and they're saying, right, I want to be an adopter. What do you have key messages that you want to transmit to them? What are the kind of, do you have bullet points in your head about what you want to communicate?
I think one of the main ones that I communicate is if your adopted child wants to find their birth family, because obviously I'm passionate about that because that's a journey I've been on, you've got to let them. You know, I had a very negative experience in that area. You know, my adopted dad reacted very badly to me trying to find my birth mother. And I can sort of see both sides if I'm on a pragmatic sort of day. I can sort of see both sides to that, you know, that he felt threatened and et cetera, et cetera. But then the other part of me thinks that's not fair because that's my right. And that's what I say to adopters. You know, there's going to be, come a day when your child probably is one of going to find out more. You know, and I know there's lots more details nowadays than when I was adopted. You know, I didn't have any details, didn't know anything. I went to get my birth file from the council and there was like one page. And I know now there's letterbox contact and, you know, all that stuff and you know, books that you write for the child and stuff. I know that. But, and I think some adopters have found that quite hard when I've said that. You know, I've got some friends who adopted and they were very much, this is our child now, you know. We don't want them to find their birth family, and almost to the point of denying the child. And they found it really difficult to do that. So yeah, that's definitely a key message. And I think, you know, just pick up something that Vicky said actually the other week. When I'm in therapy, when I've been working with adopters and foster parents, they nearly all say, I wish we'd known how hard it was going to be. And not from the point of we wouldn't have done it, just from the point of we wish that we'd known we could ask for help before they got into crisis point. And I said, that's a really big thing. I think adoption teams, not that I want to sing the praises of Adoption Teams Valley, but actually they're very good at offering that help at an early stage and being there with the, like, post-adoption care stuff. And not to be ashamed, because I think some adopters feel like they failures because, you know, they feel like they're making a mess of it. And I go, oh my goodness, you know, that's okay.
I don't know what Al's doing.
I think Al's just, off. I think he's having a stroke.
He's just collapsed. There was loads in there, and I wanted to stop you, but I wanted you to keep going as well. Just going on to the kind of, reconnecting and looking for birth family and your background and stuff. I think that's a really common kind of experience, isn't it? Because, you know, I mean, maybe not so much nowadays, but certainly, you know, maybe kind of 15, 10 years ago, people would have still been of the opinion, well, you know, once they're adopted, they're mine and that's it. I think it's really important. That's a really important message from you as well. You know, I would have felt like that years ago, but actually when the time came and it happened, I was less bothered by it because I kind of saw that as my children's right or my child's right to be able to do that. And in actual fact, it would have been my issue anyway. So that would have been for me to deal with and not to, you know, not to kind of project onto my child.
Yeah.
You know, that's an interesting one, isn't it? And there's something else you said as well, and I wanted to kind of, but I can't remember what it was because, like I say, you said so much.
Webcast gold, this Scott. Webcast gold.
always out, always.
Yeah, and I think one of the
I was just going to ask, and in terms, you know, you mentioned you were adopted and stuff. So, someone's asked actually, you know, pre 1976, what? Would you be willing to share the kind of circumstances around your adoption and what happened?
Yeah, very common. My birth mother was 17 years old, got pregnant accidentally, part of a very strict Catholic family in South Shields, very overbearing father who basically said to her, if you have this baby, you bring shame on the family. We don't want to see you again. Or the other option is to go off to an unmarried mother's home and have the baby in secret and give it up for adoption. And they were the sort of two options that she had.
Right. Wow.
Which is very, very common in the 1970s.
I ask, I mean, it's in the news today where there's a group of birth parents, birth mums, asking for an apology from the government. I think it's led by Labour MP who experienced that as a mum herself. What do you kind of understand that desire for an apology from the government? Do you see that it's relevant? Is it something that would help or not help? What's your perspective?
I mean, personally, couldn't really care less about getting an apology from the government, but I can understand that. Yes, some people it would. You know, I've had quite a positive experience through all of this. Lots of ups and downs. You know, but I understand some people haven't, you know, and that's a tough question. I've never known anything different, I guess. You know, I just sort of took it as there wasn't any details kept. My adopted parents were very secretive about it. Didn't really tell me anything about it. You know, it wasn't till my sort of late 20s that I sort of got a bit of more of a curiosity. It was never mentioned, I don't mean, what good would that do, the government? What would they be apologising for? The fact that records weren't kept, or that, I don't know, it was kept secret, or I don't know, I don't really understand.
Yeah, I mean, it's illegitimate because it's, you know, you read the headlines and that it's splashed out, but like even you reflecting your own story, my thoughts are, well, the apology maybe needs to be from family. That families were complicit in this. That's the murkiness of it, isn't it? It's not just, you know, it's not Boris Johnson saying we need to set up some homes. It's
That's a really good point, actually. Yeah, that is sort of a bit of an unknown part of my story. The family bit, the sort of birth family. I found them, but my birth mum's dad has died now. So that's sort of that bit sort of gone. And I can really appreciate how hard it was for her, and the choices that she made. I don't resent her. I don't. I've got a lot of love for her because it took a lot of courage to do that. And sometimes I wish I hadn't found her, and sometimes I'm glad I have. And it's just this roller coaster of emotions, you know. It's crazy. I read a quote today from Nancy Verrier, who wrote a book called The Primal Wound about adoption, and it was just a quote saying an adoptee is an adoptee for life. You know, it never goes away. It's not like you get over it when you're an adult.
Yeah.
it's with you all the time and in different ways, obviously, you know, as an adult would deal with things differently as a child and a teenager and everything else. But actually, yeah, you're an adoptee for life, and there's always connotations on a daily basis, you know, for me, low end stuff and sometimes very emotional stuff. But it never goes away. It never goes away.
Yeah. So do you think that adopters then, or prospective adopters, are, do you think that they can comprehend that? Do you think that there's a challenge in trying to bring people from a place of, they've seen Annie, they've watched the Disney films, and adoption is a very mature, oh, it's all okay now. Mm-hmm. Do you think that adopters, are you in it, when you're trying to prepare adopters, are you trying to counter that narrative sensitively?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, and I sort of come from a point of, I know when I was adopted, it was very much thought that you were getting a blank slate baby. Mm. I mean, it's not that common for babies, really young babies, to be adopted now. Tend to go into foster care first. But I know my parents thought they were getting a blank slate baby, but actually, you know, not to get into the whole sort of, you know, the trauma stuff, unless you want to. But I was, you know, that child has been severely traumatized before they reached the adoptive parents. And obviously adoptive parents are going to give that child all the love that they need. Of course they are. But actually there's still a bit of that child that is damaged. And I think adopters need to know. And I say this really, really respectfully and gently. Adopters sort of need to realise that, you know, one day that trauma is going to come out somehow. You know, it's a lot of the stuff that Vicky and I work with, is that this trauma that's coming up, the attachment stuff. And I think if adopters can know that and almost preempt it, and they've been prepared so much that they understand, you know, attachment. You know, I do training courses for foster carers and social workers on attachment and therapeutic parenting. Mm. And I think it's so important just to know that it's not something that they're doing wrong. Often it's just the trauma coming up. Mm. And I think when adopters can realise, I mean, how did you find that sort of element to that when you adopted?
We
I'm
don't.
Throwing questions at you now.
I was gonna say, we don't answer questions. No,
I'll start sharing. You'd never stop, to be there.
No, yeah. I think we just have a brutal, not, well, maybe it is a brutal honesty with our children from the outset. That age appropriately and as sensitively as possible, we are as honest as is bearable.
Yeah.
At each stage. And I describe it as an onion, that it's always an onion, but it's the facts, that it's a developing a knowledge around a situation. So, you know, your mum wasn't able to look after you, turned into your mum, couldn't look after you, to your mum, to your mum, shouldn't have looked after you. I mean, I guess perhaps we're talking about a different narrative. The narratives of children now are different to the narratives of your generation. I don't want to lump you into a thing, but as a whole, I have a question off the internet. Is there something, this is from Rachel Leanne, and she says, is there something you wish your parents had done as a child? Things you would have wanted to know?
That's a really interesting question. I bounce between two sort of camps on this one. I was happy not knowing. I've got a very avoidant attachment style. So I was very happy not knowing. I remember my mum sitting me down on my bed, probably my adopted mum, when I must have been about 5 or 6. You know, and I remember a very wise social worker saying to me, if a child can remember being told, then they were told too late. And I remember her just saying something like, we chose you from a hospital and we brought you home in the car and we just really love you. And something like that. And then it was never ever mentioned again. And I just think, you know, for me personally, you know, being a teenager is is ridiculous enough without that difference of being adopted. You know, I mean, I look nothing like my adopted parents or my sister, my adopted sister, who was adopted from a different family. Anyone with eyes could tell that I was no relation whatsoever to them. But it was never mentioned. My parents were very secretive about it. So to sort of think about the opposite of that for me, to know who she was, you know, where I came from, the sort of the details and reasons behind it, it's quite a scary thing. I think, to be honest, I was quite happy with a level of denial. Absolutely. My sister and I talked about it because I think that she was the only person in the world who could fully understand, because she's adopted as well. So you had this common bond. But yeah, never. It was never mentioned. Never mentioned. And obviously in the future, when I got my birth certificate and Ireland, whatever, my parents didn't even have any details to tell me. I had my original birth certificate. I was called Alexander John Casey when I was born, and my adopted parents changed my name. And that's a question that's been asked to me a lot. You know, how do you feel about your name being changed? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's never bothered me. But apart from that, they had nothing. They had no information. I had to search myself. I didn't even have the internet at the time. Remember those big microfiche things?
Yeah.
In the library. I had to use one of them to try and search for my birth. But I'm personally happy that the way it went for me. And actually, social workers asked me this when I do the prep courses. You know, would you rather it was like it was when you were adopted, or like it is now? And I've had several team managers sort of glaring at me when I say, actually, I think I prefer it what it was like before. Because obviously I'm not meant to say that, but I'm not going to laugh.
Where's the off button?
That's actually an interesting point, though, isn't it? Because actually the reforms and the changes that have been made to adoption over the years, I mean, it comes from a place where, you know, obviously a lot of people have advocated for that change. Some of the changes for the better, some of the changes aren't. I mean, you know, in terms of your own voice and how you feel that's perceived, obviously you've done a lot of work with some agencies. Do you feel listened to as an adopted adult? And do you feel that your experiences are listened to by the professionals that actually want to kind of support and help change?
Yes and no. Yes, because I've got a very interesting story, and so I'm good at telling it. And it ticks a box that we have an adult adoptee here who can tell his story. But yeah, I think, just like I said before, you know, they're very much pushing this. And it was interesting that you said there about the reform. You know, was that done for the parents, or
exactly,
was that done for the child?
That was really my question without being too direct. So,
that child doesn't have a choice to not have letterbox contact or not have sort of the storybook stuff. You know, that I guess I had a choice. The ball was in my court. You know, it was when I chose to search, And if I hadn't chosen to search, I would never have known. But children now, that choice is almost taken away from them. And that, as an adoptee, that doesn't sit right with me, actually. But it is what it is, you know, and there's lots of good things about it. But I'm happy the way it was for me, definitely.
Can I ask you about your choice to become a therapist? I mean, that's maybe that's nothing to do with adoption preparation. It's just me being nosy in a public environment where you share your innermost secrets.
Yeah, absolutely. So I worked in the chemical industry for 30 years, but also did a lot of voluntary stuff, prison work, you know, working with, you know, naughty kids and on the streets and youth work and stuff like that. And when I got involved with Adoption Tees Valley and doing the panel and the prep groups, I said to one of the team managers, I said, how can I get more involved? But because I didn't have a social work degree, she said, obviously, you know, it'd be tough for you to get into the adoption team as a professional. So, but have you considered counselling? Which I hadn't. So I enrolled on this like very, very basic counselling course at the local college, did that, and then did the next level, and then did the degree, and then yeah, just fell in love with it, really. And then, you know, set private practice, ended up working with the same agency as Vicky was working for. I would say this to someone today, I was like, my passion is working with trauma. And that sounds, you know, I've got a friend who's a therapist whose passion is working with suicide. And it sounds a bit macabre, but actually I just see it as a beautiful, beautiful thing that you can affect someone's life in such an amazing way. It's just incredible. I love it. I absolutely love it. So yeah, that's my journey of being a therapist. Left a very secure job with free healthcare and a massive pension, and went self-employed as a therapist.
You mentioned your work on the panel, and we are going to talk to people about the panel, but I'd be really interested to get your perspective, because now you're a therapist as well. Do you have any observations on the nature of the people that are coming through, and you know, what is it like to sit on a panel with that lived and professional kind of insight?
Yeah, I found foster, because I've done foster panel and adoption panel, with two very different entities. What I find with panel is most couples don't come, or people don't come to panel unless it's pretty much a yes. You know, the social worker must have had to have done a really, really bad job if we say no.
Can I just put a disclaimer on that, just in case there is anybody who's getting to panel, to say that I've sat on a few panels where it hasn't been a yes and it's been deferred. So just to kind of balance that up a little, just in case anybody thinks,
oh. I have as well. I've been on panels where we've said no before.
You're right, majority of them would be, you know, they wouldn't get that far unless the social worker and the team manager were really confident that it was going to go through.
I've been deferred three times, if that helps.
It shouldn't have gone through the last time either, but never mind.
Awesome. Well, I've no idea what your question was. Experience on panel. I found people are very nervous, most people. And we try to be really friendly and loving and caring and sort of low-key and, you know, humorous. But, you know, this is a massive decision. This is a life-changing decision. And for them to have got to that point through all the preparation groups and, you know, social work stuff, you know, which is brutal. You know, when my parents adopted, they hadn't even done any training. They were due to do the training 2 weeks after they got me. They had to borrow everything from the neighbours just to keep me alive. So obviously now it's hugely different, you know. And I think it's been really nice for me being part of the prep groups before the panel, because I often see the couples in the prep group, and then I see them on the panel as well, which is really rewarding, really rewarding. But the social workers are generally brilliant. They really just ground the couple. You know, they meet with them before and after, and obviously you've got a really great relationship. And I think that's one of the big keys for me is the quality of the social work, or social workers. Obviously, there's one for the child and one for the parents. That makes a massive difference. It really does. I don't know if that answers your question at all. I just waffled on a bit there.
I think I mean, I can totally agree with you in terms of how you want to come across on a panel. You want to come across as friendly. You want it to come across as an experience to remember for the right reasons rather than the wrong reasons. Yeah. Part of that is because of my own experience on our very first panel was not great, in the same way Al's wasn't. I mean, we weren't deferred or anything like that, but it was just a horrible experience. So in terms of kind of progressions of panels as well, I mean, I don't know how long you've been doing it, but have you seen kind of a change in the way that, you know, panels are run? And, I mean, you, Adoptees Valley, that's a regional adoption agency, isn't it?
Yeah, so I started about 10 years ago on Middlesbrough Council.
So you've had that transition as well, yeah.
So it was a dual panel. It was called Family Placement Panel. So it was fosters. We would have foster cases and adoptive cases in the same panel. Which was a bit confusing at times. And then obviously it split. The foster bit stayed in Middlesbrough, and then all the local authorities joined together for Adoptees Valley. It's very professional. A lot of reading. Oh my goodness, so much reading. I find foster panel a lot easier than adoption panel. There's a lot less to read on a Form F than there is on a PAR. And an APR and a CPR and a medical report and all the rest.
We'll translate for any listeners.
Perspective of doctors.
We do that a lot. We do that a lot. We talk in acronyms and then people go, "Oi, no acronyms, thank you." So the PAR is the first one, which is the prospective adopters report, isn't it? Which is similar to the Form F, but Form F is for fostering, and PAR is for adoption.
And CPR is child permanence. I think what comes out for me with that panel is a woe betide any social worker that's got typos in there, that's got mistakes in there. They really get pulled up, because really the essence is this report belongs to the child, and when they're old enough to read it or old enough to have it, it needs to be good. It needs to be correct. It needs to be factually accurate. And it needs to be positive. And I think that's where the reading comes in, you know, literally picking up typos and dates that are wrong, you know, that sort of thing's quite common.
I mean, the quality assurance is really a massive part, I think, in all panels I've somewhere. That's been the message, you know, in years to come, a child can pick that report up and read it. And if it's inaccurate or, you know, there are kind of, I don't know how you feel about this, but, you know, if you got a report like that, which obviously you didn't, you've got one sheet, but if you got a report like that and it wasn't accurate and there was, you know, you feel like you were just a statistic.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, totally. So that's a big part of it.
I'm going to bring you back on to preparation, because I'm mindful that we've got another guest coming for panels, haven't we, who's got a different story again. So, but your insight is appreciated. One of the things that Vicky talked about in relation to, and we sort of touched upon it, we asked her a question about it, and I can ask you a similar question, is in relation to adopters who perhaps come with their own, I don't want to say baggage, but I did, but their own, they bring their own nibbles to this buffet that they have perhaps been through rounds of IVF or not. But there's a reason why they need to come to adoption. Would you sort of advocate, or would you say there's a place for a more therapeutic preparation therapy?
Yeah.
Like a professional rooting around in the, under the hood?
Definitely. Definitely, and that's what I used to do with the agency I worked for, is we'd always work with the parents first before working with the child. But are you saying even before they've adopted the child, there should be some sort of therapeutic? Because, yeah, I absolutely agree, because at the moment it's all post-adoption stuff. You can get therapy as post-adoption support, obviously, you know, paid for by the Adoption Support Fund. That's fabulous, but yeah, there isn't really much unless you sort of pay privately to do it yourselves. There isn't much, but I just wonder if that's more of an awareness or a lack of awareness from prospective adopters that actually we need to get our stuff. We said something else there. We need to get our stuff together, sort of. Because this is big stuff. big yeah. stuff. This is big stuff. I think you're absolutely right. There's definitely a need. So maybe it's more of an awareness that needs to be sort of, that drum needs to be sort of banged in that respect. Because there's a lot of, like I said, there's a lot of post-adoption stuff, but very little pre-adoption stuff therapy-wise. Definitely.
Yeah.
I think, you know, you're absolutely right. I think as well, there's this kind of, you know, sometimes, not with all families, but there's that part where between introductions, placement, and then the adoption order, there is an element of building the family from within the family, if that makes sense, and not having too many, you know, kind of outside kind of influence, well, not influences, but, you know, outside kind of support beyond the social worker. So is that maybe not just families that need to be aware of that? Is that maybe something that social workers need to kind of look at as well, do you think?
Yeah. I mean, you're a social worker. Are you aware of?
Al is, I'm not.
Al's a social worker.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah.
I mean, what is the awareness in the social work arena for adoption therapy?
I mean, I don't work in adoption. I've danced around adoption a little bit. I don't work in adoption mainly because it would be, can you imagine, like, I came and I was your adoption social worker, you know, and I've got like, it would be just soul crushingly destroying to have me as your. And there are.
How do you do it with fostering then? I don't know what's happening. How does that work? Well,
fostering's different because I'm not a foster carer. I have been a foster carer, but it kind of, I've got enough empathy. But if, you know, I think that the problem with being an adopter is that, you know, in my kind of adoptive life is well documented. So people can Google it and they'll find enough about me to kind of go, oh, wow, he's had some pretty crazy shizzle go on. So maybe I can't talk to him about how I feel a bit sad. Do you know what I mean? So I always think that it just, there's a real separation there. I think there's this real challenge of people holding this mindset of that actually adoption is just parenting plus. It's a parenting with this other thing that's kind of hovering around. But like you were saying, you are an adoptee every day. It's present in maybe the tiniest ways or maybe the biggest of ways. And the reality is that for my children, as a good parent, you've got to be just ahead of that game. And sometimes it is about not saying anything, and sometimes it's about being the first person to say something. So I think I'm not sure. So I think that, but I guess the other thing as well is that I'm conscious that people revise for the test. If you say to people, hey, you've had a difficult experience, you've maybe your infertility, you've been through a whole round of experiences to try and, you know, you've investigations, you've tried IVF, and now you're moving on to adoption. Is that resolved? And they'll go, yeah, it's resolved.
Yeah.
Or, yeah, it's been 6 months. And you're going to go, all right, I'm not qualified to get under the hood of that one as a social worker. Yeah. But you are, as a therapist, maybe.
Yeah.
Are you?
Definitely. Shall I give you my card to put the number of the screen?
Yeah.
I mean, something's not a problem till it's a problem is sort of what you're saying, isn't it?
Yeah, kind of.
Maybe. But it's always there. It's always there. And so I think so easily triggered. Things are so easily triggered. You know, when we're put in very vulnerable situations, our vulnerabilities become very apparent. Whereas, you know, if we're just sort of just going through life and things are sort of just going okay. You know, I do a lot of stuff with dads. So when I was doing therapy with the couples, see, I'd seen the dads and I saw a lot of common themes with dads that weren't there with the mums. I've just done a dads group last week for Cornerstone. And the big thing that comes out is inadequacy. Inadequacy and not understanding why the child is behaving like they're behaving, which obviously going back to the pre-adoption therapy stuff and training and psychological education, that would sort of cover cover some of that. You know, I've had a lot of dads who were like, why is my child behaving like this? And, you know, I could sit there and say, you know, it's because of the shame, and it's the shame coming out, and it's the trauma. And, you know, we can go into all the, you know, the brain stuff. But actually, if that dad had known this before, I think in a lot of cases, they would have dealt with it better.
Yeah. Because, yeah, we, as parents, we do bring our nibbles to this buffet, don't we? Like you say, that we don't necessarily cope as well if we've got our own stuff going on. We're not necessarily the best function as well as we don't function as well as we perhaps can or should.
Yeah. It's tough.
Deep, man. But so how do you unpick that in a preparation group? Because the reality is that, you know, is the reality that most adoptive parents now are going to find themselves needing additional support? Can we say the majority?
I think so.
I would, definitely. Yeah. I mean, I've only been involved with one preparation group, so I'm not sure how would actually, no, I've been involved with two. There was one in Durham that I did. What's that adoption agency in Durham called? I can't remember. Anyway, just kidding. I went to tell my story there too. It'll come back to me. But I think it doesn't go deep enough, is what I'm trying to say. I don't think, with my therapist head on, I don't think it does. It does go deep enough. It's wonderful hearing the experience of someone who's been adopted or someone who has adopted, and their sort of journey. And actually, yeah, when you close the door and you have to keep that child alive without the social worker being there, that's sort of when the stuff hits the fan, isn't it? I guess.
I feel like your tone is lowering and you're kind of becoming more serious, and I'm genuinely scared about what you're going to say next.
Shall I start singing a song? I've got my guitar here if you want me to do a few numbers.
Please don't.
No, you're fine.
I'll lose my registration.
I think, yeah. My voice is going really low, isn't it?
Is this your therapist voice?
Yeah. It is. What are you noticing right now? what's your body doing right now?
you're therapizing the entire internet.
Yeah, you are.
Yeah. Move on quick. Ask me a question.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Now for a song. Yeah. Something different.
I was going to ask you something there, but I've forgotten what it was. So it'll come.
Oh, you're
back
on form tonight. You're on form.
Shush.
So how do you think you can engage people with that conversation? Because you can't just send them away of unpacking stuff. You've got to. Do you think the fundamental nature of how we prepare people, and other things that people have suggested as we've done the podcast, as people, I think, I can't remember who said it, was this idea that the preparation, we return to preparation intermittently. We keep bringing people back to get them ready for the next step. Would that be something you'd want? Does that make sense to you?
Oh, it definitely makes sense. I mean, you don't take everything in just doing things once. You know, with a therapeutic parenting training, I do it twice a year with the same group of, I mean, there's some new foster carers coming in all the time, of course. There's the same social workers and foster carers as refreshers and things. And the thing, you've got a captive audience as well, because especially, you know, foster carers, you know, it's part of the regulations that you have to do a certain amount of training each year.
Yeah.
With adopters, you know, you have to attend the prep groups. It's sort of mandatory. So, I mean, what an amazing platform to, you know, to get the people there, because they have to be there, you know. And I think definitely repetition, because they'll go away and think about it and talk about it and come back with more questions. You know, sometimes it throws up more questions than answers. So if they've got that platform or environment to come back and ask those questions again in the right atmosphere and with the right people, then, you know, it has to be a good thing. Absolutely has to be a good thing.
So there's a comment from Leanne, and she was saying part of their post-adoption support, they had to have some therapeutic input sessions prior to placement, and it really helped us. It was mm-hmm. it was all virtual. So that's someone sort of reflecting on them, their own journey, kind of seeing that they needed that therapeutic input. It's kind of just standard, really, just because this stuff is parenting plus. Scott, has your question come to you while I go and find another question?
No, you go and find another question. We'll just chew the fat and talk about things. You might sing a song and get his guitar. I was interested in what you said earlier. Seriously, my brain is just mushed, like, because it's just gone again, whatever it was I was going to say. I feel like I'm a bit distracted by Al's new background.
Not unreasonably. I'm very distracted. I'm sat on a leather puffy.
Can you mind your language, please? Thank you.
This is no one's ever said that to me before.
So some days I literally see I can just almost see myself in the Social Work England tribunal. If I shut my eyes, I'm there.
Fantastic.
This is a question that someone asked. We often get people asking us questions at different places in the different places in the process, of people who've a bit longer in the tooth. Sometimes we get questions of people who are in preparation and kind of going, what's happening, or matching. This is a question about someone who's even there at the step before preparation. So this is a really interesting question, and they kind of got in touch with us during the week. A potential adopter, right at the beginning of them exploring, and want to educate themselves about the complex ethics around adoption in the UK. And I said that if we got chance, we would talk about it. So is that something that you kind of see floating around? Because we laughed about it at the beginning when you kind of, you called us superheroes. There's a lot of people are questioning the ethics of adoption and severance. And is that something that you're comfortable with? Where do you sit in that? What's your perspective on those kind of complicated ethics?
That's a good question, isn't it?
I'll keep talking while you think, shall I?
I mean, there's obviously a need, isn't there? There's a need. It starts with a need. You know, if there was no need for adoption, then it wouldn't be a thing. So ethically, you know, in the context of putting the child first and the welfare of that child, I think ethically, I mean, it's almost a perfect storm, isn't it, of ethics. It's I need to be less poetic, don't I? It's the need is so great, and you know, a child doesn't have a choice, so that choice needs to be right for that child. So the importance of getting it right ethically, it doesn't get much bigger than that in life. So I think for me, I have a problem with when it's not done right. Obviously I do.
What do you mean by not done right? I mean, I think I know what you mean, but explicitly, what do you mean by that?
I guess I'm using myself as an example, you know, and I know it's not like that now, so maybe, you know, it's too historical. But, you know, adoptions weren't done right in the 1960s and 70s. I think there's a potential for overwhelm for the adopter. You know, for some friends who've adopted, I said, and they found the whole process just so stressful and so overwhelming and so deep, going into their personal lives, and they really struggled with that. But actually, I see that as a good thing. You know, we need to get it right. We need to tick every box. We need to have the right place for that looked after child to go, because, you know, 9 times out of 10 with adoption, they're there for the rest of their lives, or to the, you know, adults.
Yeah.
And I don't see many times when it's gone wrong. I've got one in my mind that, no, I've got two in my mind I've been involved with that have gone very wrong. But there was lots and lots of different reasons for that. But ethically, you know, I think it's very right.
Because I guess the voice, the counter argument to that, and I'm sort of playing devil's advocate a little bit, would be that a child potentially loses, they're severed from their biology. They're severed from their identity. And we know that how identities are formed is really complicated, but there's a big movement of contemporary adoptees sort of saying that is a price that's too big to pay. So is it, you're quite clearly
every case different. You know, I look at my adoption and I'm glad I was adopted, because of the upbringing and the life I've had compared to the life I would have had. So for me personally, I'm even though it's come with a multitude of struggles and psychological things for me, I'm glad that choice was taken from me. But I know not every case is like that. And it's very individual, isn't it? It's very individual, but it's hard to sort of accept that individuality when it's a child who can't, you know, doesn't really have a voice. I can sit here, I've got a voice now. You know, I can wax lyrical and preach about adoption and how amazing it is and superheroes and stuff. But actually a child who's been removed doesn't have that voice. So that's the ethics question. That's an amazing question, man. I need to go away and think about that one. It's multifaceted, isn't it? It really is.
Yeah. I mean, Scott will testify to this. If you went onto Twitter tonight and you said, I'm an adoptee and I'm glad I was adopted, I can guarantee if you...
You would be off Twitter within a couple of hours, I would say, probably.
Wow. It'd be a robust rebuttal.
I think as adoptive parents, you know, I find it really difficult. I find it incredibly difficult, actually, to read some of the stuff that is aimed within the own adoptee community, if you like. It's kind of, there's two sides to it. Well, there's probably more than two sides of it. There's those that are really against adoption and are really, you know, they call themselves defogged, I think is the word that they use. So they've come out of the adoption fog and they see adoption for what they believe it is. And whilst, you know, and this is just my view, you know, I'm not an adopted adult. I don't, you know, I've not had that experience. But certainly anybody who comes in, like Al says, and says that they're really positive about adoption, then they're seen as people who are in the fog and who haven't kind of come through that yet. And there's some in between, you know, there's some who kind of straddle both those, but you know, generally the ones that are really against it, they're pretty within one community that wants to have their voice heard. It's very confusing for an outsider looking into that and seeing kind of that conversation go on. If that makes sense.
Yeah, I found that quite hard to understand.
Yeah, I wouldn't go near adoptee Twitter then if I was you.
Well, sorry. I think
I'm not on Twitter.
Just keep it that way. It's easier.
I think it's valid that people express their own views. I think that the complexity
free speech.
I think the complexity is that, for example, your experience of adoption is wholly different to a 13-year-old now, isn't it? It's the same words, but different system. Different society, different world that they're growing up in, where the option for not telling isn't there anymore, is it? You know, if you've got a mobile phone,
exactly,
it's complicated.
Yeah, I kept it a secret. Kept it a secret for 20-odd years. You know, that couldn't happen now.
What can I mean? That's really honest of you. Was that a secret from everyone, or was that just...
That was a secret. I even remember concocting stories to say that I was born in a different place, that you know, that my parents were my adopted parents were my real parents. And I remember me and my sister sort of having that story that I was born in a Middlesbrough General Hospital, you know, because that's where we lived. Because, yeah, maybe it was shame, a bit of shame there. I think my adopted parents didn't have, because they didn't talk about it. But on the other side of that is, I didn't want to talk about it. So yeah, it's a right mixture, honestly.
Yeah. I mean, I was looking into this, and I'm really intrigued by the idea of how we form identity just generally. And I just started to browse and looking at some research around adoption and formation of identity, because I think that's one of the key, it's a huge complication to overlay. And it kind of, the research was sort of saying, well, actually there's a third of people who are really, really quite unhappy and kind of, and it's kind of, it's just, it sits on them constantly. There's a third of people who are kind of like, it's floating around. And there's a third of people who are just, like adopted people who are just going, so what? And so, my feeling is that the third who are finding it difficult and can't shake it off are the ones on who are vocal about it and want to see change. So maybe their voices are. I feel like I'm on really thin ice, Scott. There's going to be stern letters, but I'm up for it.
Just be trolling. Trolling. You know, anybody who doesn't agree with us or we don't agree with them, it's trolling. That's it.
A bit of light trolling of a Wednesday. Yeah. Those are the people who are lobbying for change, and that's fair enough. That's fine. But then perhaps they're overrepresented. Likewise, within the adoption community, we're lobbying for change. We're overrepresented.
Yeah. Exactly. And, you know, a prime example is this Festival of Debate tomorrow night, which is the Myths and Myths Around Adoption. It's being put on by adult adoptees who have, rightly so, decided to kind of come behind this and try and share their experiences and talk about trauma, where it comes from, is adoption trauma, etc. I'm a speaker at that event, but as is a birth mum, as is four or five different adopted adults. Now that's the right thing for that. What is he doing now? I don't know. He's wandering around switching his lights on now. But that's the right way. But this is a community working together, which for me is the perfect way to be able to do it. Because actually, if we all are working together, adopted parents have had that platform for so many years. Hold our hands up to that and say, yes, we've had that platform. And now's the time for that platform to be shared, because we all have experiences that can contribute. Birth parents, foster carers, you know, who foster children who've moved on to adoption, adoptive parents, adopted young people, children, adults. We all, there is a space for everybody, but we all have to kind of work together to get that message through that, you know, of what's happened.
Yeah. Scott, someone's asked for a link to that. Could you put a link in the comments?
Yes, I shall. I'll find that now while you chat away. Yeah,
and I think what I find hard that is that when there's one side of that is a very loud voice, like you were saying there about if I went on Twitter and said I'm really chuffed out of stuff, that's it's not balanced, is it? That sort of, I was going to say poisons. That's too extreme, but it taints the whole thing, I think, you know, because it's subjective. It's totally you know, my sister has a very different, or did have a very different outlook and opinion and desire to me, even though we grew up together, we had the same adopted parents, you know, she had a very, very different attitude to it to me. And we grew up in the same house.
I find that's a fascinating conversation, having siblings as well, and how they deal with things. You know, they're adults now, but how they even deal with things now so differently, connected to their reasoning, the reasons, the contact that they have or don't have. They're like chalk and cheese, you know. Yeah. But then that's how people are generally, isn't it? You know, just me and my brother.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, me and my brother were chalk and cheese as well. But we were both right in our own way, because, you know, that's how we went on to live our life.
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of it comes down to attachment styles. You know? Yeah. Absolutely does.
I've got lots of children, but three of them share, but all the biology is the same, and they've all got three unique perspectives on contact, their birth family, on us, on everything. And that's their right, totally their right. And the challenge for us is to keep them all, us all play happy families. That's the challenge.
Yes.
But that, again, is speaks to us as the role as an adoptive parent when children reach adulthood. Is it's kind of, it's that's preparation for that is different. I'm looking at the time, Scott. Scott, we're going to have to...
I know.
There's no money to put in the meter. We're running out of time.
No. Yeah.
David, this has been fantastic.
Yeah, it has. Thank you.
Yeah. Oh, thank you for having me. It really has. It's been great.
An hour probably isn't long enough to go into all the ins and outs, but I think we have definitely covered quite a lot with you. And we could definitely think about having you back at some point to do a recording rather than a live. It's better when you record because you can say the S word, because I'll then afterwards, so it's all fine. So just before we wrap up, David, thank you so much. Really appreciate your time. We're having a break next week, aren't we, Al? Because you're tired, but bless you, old man.
Half term. It's half term holiday. We're going to have a little break, and then we're going to work out what we're going to do next and do a few more.
I love how you say half term. Here, it's the beginning of the summer holidays on Friday for 13 weeks. I know. 13 weeks.
It's fantastic if you were a teacher.
Yeah.
Well, I think, potentially. I just think it's 13 weeks a bit long after the 4 months of not being at school this year. Yeah. I don't know. I'm just putting that out there.
There's a survey somewhere where there's like a teacher satisfaction scale, and I bet the Irish teachers are the happiest teachers in the world.
Bless
them. So we're going to have a break next week, but we're going to be back the week after. So the week after half term, and we are going to because we've got so many people come forward for this, and it's just about really how we progress through the kind of process of preparation, isn't it? So we'll announce that next week, hopefully, who we're going to have on the week after.
We need to work it out, don't we?
We do, basically. That's it.
Basically, yeah.
And I've put the link to the Eventbrite for the What Are the Myths and Truths of Adoption tickets for tomorrow night, 7 o'clock. 7:30 till 9. It is. It's live and it's on Zoom. If anyone wants to join us, and like I say, it's been put on by two adult adoptees and on through Festival of Debate, RML and Adoptee Futures. And it should be really interesting, actually. I've seen the kind of the
thing. It looks great.
It does look good, actually. So, so if you can join us tomorrow, that'd be really good. I won't be there, it's just me, because you're busy, aren't you? Bless you.
No, because they sent the invite out and you went, oh, I'll do that. And then you just literally said, I'll do that. And then shut the door on me.
Yeah, because normally it's you that gets in there first. And I just thought, I'm doing this one.
Anyway, let's fight behind
closed
doors.
We'll keep our
doors.
Domestic for... David, thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure.
Yeah. Really appreciate it,
Absolute star. And look after yourself and we'll get you back on.
Yeah.
Thank definitely. You. And I won't go on Twitter.
You're out. Excellent. Bye-bye.
Bye.